it is Ryan Seacrest here, and if you're looking for some serious fun, head over to ChumbaCasino.com. At Chumba Casino, you can play all your favorite social casino-style games for free anytime, anywhere. It's the most fun you can have on your phone or computer.
No purchase necessary. VGW Group. Void where prohibited by law. See terms and conditions. 21 plus.
On the morning of December 15, 1995, 36-year-old John Markley and his 32-year-old wife Shelley went to the bank to cash a check. But by later that afternoon, the couple had seemingly disappeared without a trace. Their five children came home from school to an unlocked house and several things out of place. More than 30 years later, after a ransom note, a strange encounter at a bank, and a possible suspect arrested, the question continues to linger. What happened to John and Shelley Markley? Hey everyone, welcome back to Detective Perspective. My name is Derek Levasseur. I'm a licensed private investigator and former police detective. Each week I'll be covering an unsolved case in story format. I'll then give you my perspective on the investigation and provide contact information for the individuals or organizations connected to the case so that if you have any tips, you can contact them directly and maybe you can help solve a case. So if you're someone who's interested in true crime, specifically unsolved cases, and you would like to hear my opinion on those investigations, please consider subscribing whether you're watching on YouTube or listening on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or whatever platform you use. Now, you may have heard in the teaser here, there's going to be a lot that happens in this case. We're going to go through everything. I'm going to give you the timeline, let you know the state of the crime scene when it was first discovered. But then we're going to talk about some things that we've never discussed on Detective Perspective. I'm pretty sure this is the first time we're ever going to discuss someone being arrested for an extortion attempt directly involving our victims, right? This is going to be a failed attempt to elicit ransom for our victims. And yet here we are 30 plus years later. And if I'm covering the case, then you know it's not solved. So I'm sure you're wondering, how do we get there? How do we identify someone who clearly was after money for our victims, and yet we're sitting here with Derek right now discussing this case, wondering not only what happened to them, but who's responsible. And I do think this is one of those cases where we can use critical thinking, reasonable deduction, and kind of come to a couple conclusions, but nothing's concrete. And as long as Shelley and John are still out there, it would be irresponsible to say definitively what happened and where they are. So I want to go over everything. We're going to talk about the case. We're going to get into this crazy part of the story that sounds like a movie. And then you guys can tell me what you think at the end in the comments. And I will say, for full disclosure, when I was doing my part of the research here, although I like to cover cases that haven't been covered by anyone, there have been a couple other podcasts who have discussed John and Shelley's case. So this may not be the first time you've heard this one, but it's been a little while and the case still hasn't been solved. So I want to take a shot at it as well. And I think we bring a different angle where we're not just covering it. We're also looking at it from the perspective of what was done, what can be done, and how can we all come together to finally get some answers. And so with that all out of the way, we have a lot to cover. So let's dive into this week's case. John Markley Jr., who went by Johnny, and his twin sister Bonnie, were born in 1959 in Valdosta, Georgia. The family later relocated to Trumbull County, Ohio, approximately an hour east of Cleveland, where John and Bonnie grew up alongside their six siblings. Not long after graduating high school, John married a woman named Shelley Renee Applequist. Shelley, who was born in 1963, had deep roots in Trumbull County, where her family had lived for generations. The couple went on to welcome five children: Ruth, Stacy, Bonnie, Crystal, and John Jr. Shelley stayed home with the kids while John worked as a semi-truck driver, and he eventually owned his company and hired multiple employees. By the fall of 1995, The family of seven had settled into a home on Greenville Road, also known as Ohio 88, in the remote area of Bristolville and Farmington in Trumbull County. If you look at the area, the map's going to be up on the screen here. You can see their house. You can see this main road that they're located on. And there is a house that you can see to the left there. But this isn't a populated neighborhood. There aren't houses all around, although it is on a main road. The one thing I will point out about this area is that there's a lot of woods around, right? Farmland, woods. It's just a place to me when I look at it, even when you zoom out a little bit, it's a place that would be very easy to get lost in. You look further north and even to the south, southwest especially, it's just nothing but foliage. To me, that is important, especially considering the fact that we're sitting here 30 years later and we still have no idea where John and Shelley are. So when I'm looking at this and as you're looking at it, there's not a lot to take in here. It's going to come more into play when we talk about the specifics involving the home and how the children found the house. But I wanted to give you a visual of what you were looking at and what you should be considering when you're thinking about the area that this crime occurred. For anybody who's not on YouTube and you're just listening on audio, strongly recommend mark down this timestamp, go look at it on YouTube, and then you can go back to the audio. By the fall of 1995, John and Shelley were in their 30s and had been married for 16 years. Their five children ranged in age from 7 to 15 years old. The couple had worked really hard over the years, and by then their home was completely paid off. And for anybody who's a homeowner, you know how difficult that is to do, and I think for most of us, it's a pipe dream, but that's a big accomplishment. On top of that, they also had a freezer stocked full of food for the winter, something that was especially important when you think about the fact that they were raising five kids. And again, someone who didn't grow up with a lot of money, having a fridge and freezer full of food, sometimes that was a really big deal. And although things were going good for the Markley family, life could have been happier. For the past 3 years, John's twin sister Bonnie, who I mentioned at the top of the show, had been battling breast cancer, and by late 1995, she had been told that she wasn't going to survive. John took time off work to spend Bonnie's final weeks with her, and on December 13th, she passed away with John by her side. John took Bonnie's death extremely hard. After she died, a lot of people were saying that he just constantly looked like he was red and puffy in the face because he was just crying all the time, and all he kept saying was, "Part of me is gone. Part of me is gone." And you got to think about that. Your twin sister, she's been with you since day one. And I have a brother, we're 13 months apart, but the connection that we have, basically because all I ever remember is life with him, I can't imagine what that would be like for them, just knowing that they entered the world together and unfortunately they wouldn't be leaving together. And so knowing that he was going to have to go on still relatively young without that, you know, partner that you've had your entire life, it's extremely difficult. And I'm sure a lot of you can empathize with him. I'm sure, unfortunately, some of you out there have probably gone through similar circumstances. A viewing for Bonnie was scheduled for the evening of December 15th, and the funeral would take place the following day on December 16th. But tragically, John and Shelley would never make it to either. On the morning of December 15th, Shelley made breakfast for the children before sending them off to school. But when the five Markley children came home that afternoon, something immediately felt off. The family's Chevy truck was gone, all four doors of the house were unlocked, and no one was home. There were no signs of forced entry and no note explaining where John and Shelley had gone, and as the kids walked through the house, several things stood out to them. In the kitchen, the coffee pot was still on and had nearly boiled dry. Shelley's cigarettes and lighter sat on the counter, which immediately stood out because she never went anywhere without them, not even to run a quick errand. The Morning Journal reported that there was also half a cup of coffee sitting next to the cigarettes, and her purse and credit cards had been left behind too, though her checkbook wasn't there. John's watch was also sitting on a shelf above the stove, and according to the family, John never went anywhere without that watch. In the second floor primary bedroom, the cabinet holding John's gun collection was unlocked in a jar, and that was something that the children had never seen before. The cabinet was never left unlocked, and you would assume that would be for safety measures, right? You got young kids running around the house. You don't leave your gun cabinet open because nothing good's going to come from that. In addition to the gun cabinet, a small safe, which was normally kept inside a walk-in closet, was also open and sitting on a bathroom sink. There were birth certificates and other papers that were inside the safe, and they had been pulled out and were scattered all over the place. I also tried to look up to see if there was any known information out there as to whether or not John and Shelley had left money or valuables inside the safe. That's something that I thought was important, especially when we're trying to narrow down a possible motive. This safe, which was normally in this walk-in closet, being out on the sink like that, open, doesn't make a lot of sense. And you have to wonder who would have known that the safe was in there, and was there information available to the public, and at least in that area, where certain people would have known that they did in fact keep cash or valuables inside this safe. If that was the case, then we would want to definitely go speak to those people. But the fact that I haven't seen any mention of it leads me to believe that even if they were keeping valuables inside that safe, it was something that was kept in-house. In addition to the safe, the bed had also been left unmade. Lying on top of the rumpled sheets were John's suits and a couple formal outfits belonging to Shelley. Now, these were the clothes they had planned to wear to Bonnie's viewing and funeral, already laid out and ready to go. The children then went to the garage and they noticed something else. The protective tarps that John used to cover his prized 1978 Corvette were gone. According to loved ones, John never left that car uncovered. Even with these red flags, the children were not immediately worried that something terrible had happened. They knew that both John and Shelley had been struggling emotionally after Bonnie's death, and they wondered if maybe their parents had gone for a drive to clear their heads. So with the viewing hours for Bonnie only a few hours away, they believed that John and Shelley would be back soon. But just in case, the children called their aunt and uncle, Judy and Tom, who lived less than 5 miles away, and the couple came over and waited for John and Shelley to return. But by 5:30 p.m., it was time to leave for the funeral home, and John and Shelley still had not returned. So Tom and Judy took the children with them, hoping the couple would meet them there. Judy thought for sure that John and Shelley would show up, but they never did. And by the time the viewing hours ended at 9 p.m., there was still no sign of them. So Judy gathered up the children and brought them back to the house, and when they got there, it was still empty. As the night went on, Judy started calling anyone she could think of, hoping someone had seen or heard from John and Shelley, but there was no sign of them anywhere. So at approximately 12:30 a.m. on December 16th, Judy contacted the Trumbull County Sheriff's Office and reported the couple and their pickup missing. She explained that John had been depressed and distraught after Bonnie's death, but no amount of grief would make him and Shelley leave their 5 children behind without warning. Something was wrong. Deputies said they would keep an eye out for the couple and the truck, which relatives described as a red and silver 1990 Ford 4x4 with a cellular antenna and a loud muffler. Later that morning, relatives gathered at the house and tried to straighten things up. Then Bonnie's funeral was held, and the only members of the Markley family not there were John and Shelley. The following day, Trumbull County investigators located the Markley's pickup truck in the parking lot of Stambaugh's, a home improvement store on Elm Road at the north end of Warren. Unfortunately, no one in the shopping plaza area could say how long the truck had been there. All right, so if you're on YouTube, you're currently seeing a Google Earth satellite image of Stambaugh's in 1994. And I was looking around the area. There's not much that stands out. What is interesting is, although the establishments have changed, I believe Stambaugh's is now a Goodwill, and there's a Planet Fitness in that parking lot as well. But the structures are relatively the same now compared to 1994, April 20th, 1994. So the only things that really stand out to me is, first and foremost, this was 15 miles from the Markley home, south of the Markley home. There's a main road that it's right off of there, so there is some risk by dropping the car off there. I do wonder if the Markleys had dropped the car off there and then got into another vehicle. That'll make more sense in a little bit. But overall, even as you zoom out, there's not much there that stands out to me. Again, it's a main road. It appears to be a residential area. There's a lot of houses surrounding this plaza. So you would like to think that maybe someone would have noticed something, but unfortunately, and we've seen it in other cases, sometimes you don't get lucky. Sometimes it's just not the case. Or you just haven't found that person yet. Investigators examined the truck, noting the doors were locked and the keys were missing. According to the Times Recorder, the truck looked like it had been driven off-road. and it was so dirty that someone had actually written "wash me" in the dirt coating on the doors, which is not out of the ordinary. You know, there's kids all the time that do that. I think everyone has seen that before in a parking lot somewhere. But the reason it was important in this case is because the family later told investigators that this was a red flag for them because John took really good care of his cars and he would never leave them dirty. And the dirt itself actually stood out as well, because while the Markleys lived in a remote area, it wasn't the type of place you would need to drive off-road. I'm going to put up the map on the screen here again, and you can see that the Markley home is right off a two-lane highway. So there's really no immediate explanation as to how the truck got that dirty that fast. But again, as I said at the top of the show, when you look around, there's a lot of woods. And you think about 15 miles between the Markley home and the plaza where it was eventually found, there's a lot of places they could have gone. And I think all of us, when we talk about critical thinking, reasonable deduction, your head starts to go to a bad place, right? When you think about a car being so dirty, that would suggest a remote area. And when you have two people that are missing, I think the main thought that comes to mind is that wherever this truck was, it wasn't a place that was highly populated, which would allow you to leave something there that would hopefully never be found. Investigators eventually got into the locked cab of the truck and found the couple's cell phone sitting right on the console. This is unfortunate because we knew they had a cell phone and you would like to think you could triangulate their locations as they were traveling around based on what cell towers their phone was bouncing off of. But clearly, and I don't even know if the phone was on, it was left behind. And more than likely, that's because they were told they couldn't take it. Now, one more thing that I want to mention, because it's going to become important later, that the checkbook missing from Shelley's purse, that wasn't found in the truck. Those two tarps that I had mentioned earlier that John used to cover his Corvette, they were found in the bed of the truck. And on top of these tarps was the tire belonging to a semi-truck. And I think that's significant. I think if we're going to talk about theories and the fact that John and Shelley may have been forced to go into this truck, they wouldn't have brought these tarps and then put a tire on top of it. Wouldn't make a lot of sense to me. If there's something I'm missing, please, someone out there, let me know. But my first impression, my first reaction to this is that even though it wasn't normal for John to take the tarps off the car, I think he might have. I think he might have needed them for this semi-truck tire. And so he put the tarps down and put the tire on top of it. That may have happened a day or two before, and maybe the children didn't notice it. But I don't think that the tarps are involved with whatever crime happened here. And when I first heard about the tarps being removed and the fact that they were never removed, I was concerned for the obvious reasons, right? You think about tarps, you think about a dirty truck, potentially a remote area. And what are you thinking? John and Shelley were wrapped up in these tarps. They were transported to this remote area and they were dumped there. So I was thinking when I was first reading this, we're not going to find the tarps, because if we ever find the tarps, we're going to find John and Shelley. So I'm happy at least that that's not the case. And we're just getting started. I know I talked at the beginning of this episode about this extortion attempt, this ransom request, someone being arrested, someone being tied to John and Shelley, being involved in all of this. And yet we don't know what happened to him. And we're going to get into it because it's like a movie. We're going to talk about it right after the break. I'm excited to tell you about the world's number one expanding garden hose, the Pocket Hose Ballistic. If you've listened to any of my episodes recently, you know I'm a huge fan of the Pocket Hose. I have been trying to get my lawn right. I'm growing in some new grass seed. I usually have my Frenchie out there with me, and he loves to bite through the hoses. I've also had issues with just durability in the past. And then the weight of the hose is ridiculous. You're trying to uncoil it and you're trying to move it around different objects. And it's a pain in the, you know what, and it just deters you from wanting to do it. But with the Pocket Hose Ballistic, it's lightweight, it's durable, it shrinks down when I'm not using it automatically. And then when I turn the water, it expands to the length I need. I have two hoses right now, a 25 footer and a 75 footer. And this thing is literally bulletproof. It's made with a liquid crystal polymer, which is the same material used in bulletproof vests. And this hose has over 100 patents, so it's the real deal. I also love that it comes with a pocket pivot, which not only matches the hose, but is also as durable. and it gives you 360-degree rotation at the spigot. So no matter where you go in the yard, it follows and the water flows. Exactly what I'm looking for. And now, for a limited time, when you purchase Pocket Hose Ballistic, you'll get a free 360-degree rotating pocket pivot and a free thumb drive nozzle, which I use on both my hoses, matches the hose, just as durable, multiple settings, absolutely love it, and it completes the set. And so if you like what you hear, just text DETECTIVE to 64000. That's DETECTIVE to 64000 for two free gifts with your purchase. One more time, text DETECTIVE to 64000. Message and data rates may apply. All right, we're back. So after the truck was found, investigators were assigned to the case. They searched the area around the Markley home and looked for anything that might explain what happened. Investigators then started interviewing relatives and neighbors. And through those conversations, they determined that the last person to see John and Shelley at the home was their youngest child, 8-year-old John Jr. He told investigators that on the morning of December 15th, his mother gave him a bowl of cereal for breakfast. After he finished eating, he and Shelley walked to the end of the driveway to wait for the school bus, which arrived at approximately 8:30 a.m. This was the last time he saw either of his parents. In addition to those interviews, investigators also went to the Markley home, hoping to find additional evidence that might be helpful, but by that point, the house had already been compromised because relatives had cleaned up and organized everything. If you remember what I mentioned earlier, the day of the funeral, relatives had responded over to the house that morning and kind of cleaned up to help Shelley and John. They weren't trying to hurt the case, so I don't fault anyone. It's just an unfortunate set of circumstances. Even with that being the case, investigators did ask family members if anything appeared to be missing, but the relatives, they weren't sure. They believed that John may have recently sold some of his guns, making it difficult to know whether or not anything was actually missing from his gun collection. And as far as I can tell, investigators were never able to determine if any of the firearms were actually missing. However, they said there was no evidence of a gun being fired inside the home. The only thing they knew for sure was missing from that house was the couple's checkbook. So investigators looked into John and Shelley's bank account, and to their surprise, they learned that the couple's last activity happened on December 15th at approximately 10:36 a.m., which was about 2 hours after Shelley had walked her son to the bus stop. And this is a major break in the case, right? Because up to this point, they're thinking the last person to see John and Shelley is John Jr. He's relatively young, doesn't have a lot to report, and that the window is at 8:30 a.m. That's the last reported sighting. Now you have 10:36 at a public place. This is significant because you're thinking someone there is going to remember this interaction. And the transaction took place at a bank approximately 7 miles north of the Markley home in Bloomfield. And I will say, Haley and I went crazy on this, trying to find out what bank this actually occurred at. There's multiple sources on this, and these sources report different banks. Some say it was a Bank One, others say it was Cortland Bank. Either way, the bank was in Bloomfield, and that's what's important here. So investigators go to this bank, and they speak with the bank teller who handled the transaction and learn that she actually knew John and Shelley. Maybe not personally, but she recognized them from previous interactions. So she remembered them pulling up to the bank in their pickup truck with John behind the wheel. Meanwhile, Shelley signed the check on the dashboard. Now the check was made out to cash for $1,000, and the money she was withdrawing came from a $1,500 loan the couple had received weeks earlier to buy new tires for John's semi-truck. Now after that withdrawal, the couple had a remaining balance of $865, but there was never any activity on that account after that. But here's the thing. There was one detail about that interaction with the teller that was by far the most significant. You see, when John pulled up in his truck, Shelley was sitting between John and another man, someone the teller did not recognize. And according to the Tribune Chronicle, she described the man as slender with dark hair, but beyond that, she could not provide much of a description. And that's unfortunate. I do think, though, that if she were to see this man again, she probably would be able to identify him, but only she can answer that. And as you would expect, investigators immediately started trying to identify the mystery man seen with John and Shelley. And just days later, on December 19th, they publicly announced they believe foul play was involved in the couple's disappearance. Meanwhile, the Markley children remained at the family home, where John's sister Linda and her husband Gene moved in to care for them. Christmas came and went without John and Shelley. Then a day or two later, Gene answered a strange phone call. A man with a raspy voice was asking for the Markley's oldest daughter, Ruth. Gene told the caller that Ruth was asleep. The man then asked to speak with John's sister. Gene explained that Linda was sleeping too and offered to take a message, but instead, the caller hung up. The next day, Gene got another call that seemed to come from the same man, but this time the call took a disturbing turn. The caller explained that he had John and Shelley and said they would be, quote, sacrificed to a cult on New Year's Eve unless Gene came up with $10,000. The man then hung up the phone. About a minute later, the phone rang again. It was the same caller, but this time the man told Gene to sell the Markley's Corvette to raise the money. Linda and Gene immediately contacted the sheriff's office, and investigators provided them with a suction cup recording device so they could tape the next call if the man reached out again. On the morning of December 31st, they got exactly what they wanted. Gene received another call. And this time, the man instructed him to go to the Rally's fast food restaurant near Eastwood Mall off of Ohio 422 in Warren. He was told to retrieve a note from the change slot of the payphone and that note would contain instructions for dropping off the ransom. So at this point, Gene and the investigator that he was working with drove in separate cars and followed the instructions. The investigator found the note inside the payphone, and it had been handwritten in all capital letters and contained several spelling errors. There was no signature, which you obviously wouldn't expect. The note read, quote, "Go to Kaufman's entrance next to the mall entrance. Park in front next to sidewalk. Once inside door, go left to sweatshirts with penguin bird on them. Put package between shirts and leave by same door. Then drive to back of JCPenney entrance. Go into telephone next to restrooms. Wait 15 minutes. If no law enforcement is seen, a boy will give you a note with address. If any law or anything doesn't look right, go back and get package because no deal." After reading the note, Gene and the detective came up with a plan where they filled a bag with dish towels instead of money. Then Gene and a different investigator, wearing street clothes and posing as a shopper, went to the mall and dropped the bag off in the designated spot. The investigator then watched the display of sweatshirts with the Youngstown State University Penguin mascot, but no one stopped to get the bag. So Gene went back to the location, picked up the bag, and then met with the lead investigator in the parking lot to come up with another plan. And they decided to try the process one more time. But as Gene was about to drop off the bag for a second time, dispatchers radioed the investigator with new information. A caller had contacted the Markley home and told Linda he had seen police at the mall and they were not following directions. The man then gave a new drop location. This time it was the bathroom of Sunoco, a gas station and convenience store at Ohio 422 and North Road. So after getting these new directions, Gene and the lead investigator drove approximately a half a mile west to this new location, and following the instructions, Gene walked into the restroom, left the bag there, and walked out. From the parking lot approximately 50 yards away, the investigator watched the restroom door. And within minutes, a person wearing a hooded jacket walked inside, and as the hooded figure came back out, a man in a white car drove up. At that moment, deputies swarmed in, and the driver and hooded figure were both taken into custody. Right away, the lead investigator recognized both of them. These two individuals had also stopped at the display in Kaufman's. They had paused near the Penguin sweatshirts but never touched the bag, so investigators didn't think much of it at the time. The driver was identified as 45-year-old Stephen Durst. The hooded figure was Stephen's teenage daughter, Deanna, who was 9 months pregnant. As it turns out, Stephen was a truck driver who had previously worked for John. Approximately a year earlier, when Stephen had fallen on hard times, the Markleys actually let him and his two school-aged children stay with them. But while they were living together, there was a dispute over money between John and Stephen. Stephen was eventually fired and kicked out of the home, and according to the Markleys' relatives, John also withheld Stephen's final paycheck. So you're looking at someone here who's reaching out, trying to obtain a ransom for John and Shelley, And when they finally figure out who this person is, he happens to be a former employee who would have known the internal components of John and Shelley's home. He would have known about the safe. He probably would have known about the gun collection. And we have a motive. Stephen feels like John owed him money. We have more to cover. We're going to talk about it right after this break. Between diets, workouts, and endless advice, it's hard to know what actually works for weight loss and what's worth your time. That's why Hers offers access to an affordable range of FDA-approved GLP-1 medications that now include the Wegovy pill and the Wegovy pen. With Wegovy at Hers, you can lose up to 20% or more of your body weight when combined with diet and exercise. It helps regulate your appetite, helps you eat less, and most importantly, helps you keep that weight off. And the process is simple. Everything happens 100% online. You connect with a licensed provider who determines if treatment is right for you, and if prescribed, medication gets delivered right to your door. No insurance necessary. Plus, you get access to ongoing support, care team messaging, and lifestyle tools designed to help you build habits that actually last. Ready to reach your goals? Visit forhers.com/detective to get personalized, affordable care that gets you. That's forhers.com/detective. One more time, forhers.com/detective. Weight loss by Hers is not available in all 50 states. Wegovy is a registered trademark to Novo Nordisk AS. To get started and learn more, including safety information, Wegovy clinical study information, and restrictions, visit forhers.com. Cravings aren't just about nicotine, they're about habit. The hand-to-mouth motion, oral fixation, the momentary pause. When that loop is broken, cravings spike, and Fume replaces your habit with a flavored air fidget device that gives your hands and mouth something to do, distracting cravings without nicotine, vapor, or batteries. So don't just try to quit. Upgrade that habit loop and reach for a Fume instead. If you don't know, Fume is a flavored air device designed to help people quit smoking or vaping by breaking that hand-to-mouth pattern. And as I just mentioned, no nicotine, no batteries, no vapor, just clean, natural flavors and a fidget-friendly design that actually feels good to use. And you guys, if you've been with me for a while, you've seen my Fume before. I say it all the time. I love the look. I love the feel. It's got some weight to it. It's real metal, real wood. It matches my desk if you're watching on video. And I love the fidget aspects of it. It's got the twisting, right? If you can hear that, a little ASMR. It's also got the magnets. And that's what I normally use the most, but I try not to do it when I'm recording because obviously that's not going to be too appealing for you guys. I also love the flavor. My personal favorite is orange vanilla, but they also have raspberry and crisp mint. So whatever your preference, they got something for you. And we all know how it goes when you try to break a bad habit or a routine, right? The first week or so, it's relatively easy. You're like, I got this. But then your brain starts to negotiate with you and you start to try to find compromises so you can do what you want to do, but without feeling bad about it. Fume will help you replace that old motion or that routine without falling back into that old pattern. And if you're ready to give Fume a shot, now is a great time to do so because when you grab your journey pack, you'll also get a free gift just for using my code DETECTIVE. Fume has already helped over 700,000 people take steps toward better habits, and now it's your turn. So use my code DETECTIVE to get a free gift with your journey pack. Head over to tryfume.com. That's TRYFUM.com. And use my code DETECTIVE to claim your free gift today. All right, we're back. So let's talk a little bit more about Stephen, because after he was arrested, deputies did search his car, but found no sign of John or Shelley. Additionally, the bag of towels was not in the car either. In fact, it was still in the restroom. And I think there's a couple reasonable explanations as to why that was. First off, maybe Deanna had seen something before she went inside the restroom, decided not to grab it. The second option is, I don't know, maybe she's not the brightest bulb and just didn't see it. The third and most likely option is that when she went into the bathroom, she found the bag, opened it up, realized that it was towels and knew it was a setup, and tried to get out of there. And unfortunately, it didn't work out for her. I think that's the most likely explanation here. So Stephen and Deanna were taken in for questioning, and Deanna said she had no idea what was going on. She just did what her dad had asked, and investigators believed her, so she was released. In Stephen's interview, he admitted trying to get money out of the family. However, he denied having anything to do with John and Shelley's disappearance. He said he had no knowledge about where they were. He was just trying to take advantage of the situation to scam money out of the family. And I don't think I have to say it here, but I will. If he truly is not involved, what a scumbag. What an absolute piece of shit. There's no other way to put it. I mean, I don't swear a lot on this channel, but I think it's deserving so here. Like, to take advantage of the situation where you have two people who are leaving behind five kids, nobody knows where they are, and you're worried about the money that this guy owes you, and you're trying to extort them and paint a picture that their loved ones are being held captive. Like, what type of person does something like that? So I don't even have to look into anything else about Stephen to know he's the worst of the worst. But that's not what we're here for, right? We're here to find John and Shelley, and we're trying to find out how Stephen fits into that equation. Is he telling the truth, or is there more to the story? So at that point, Stephen volunteered to take a lie detector test, and he was asked the following questions. Were you involved in John and Shelley's disappearance in any way? Did you see John and Shelley after they were reported missing? Do you know where John and Shelley are now? Did you know in advance that John and Shelley disappeared? Now, the Plain Dealer reported that Stephen's answers did in fact show signs of deception. However, a polygraph expert was unable to discern which of the questions specifically resulted in an indication of a lie. I don't really know exactly what to make of this. I've dealt with polygraph tests before, both in my career, but more importantly on Breaking Homicide. We had a lot of them. And in most instances, you ask the questions one by one. So it's very easy to identify which question they showed signs of deception on. However, there are times when they do a statement analysis instead. And in that case, and I'm not an expert in this area, but it's the entire statement that's taken, and they use the manner in which it's written to determine if there's something false within it. But the problem with that is, like it describes here, you're really unable to determine exactly what they're lying about. And in my experience, if you do a statement analysis and it does come back showing signs of deception, then you step it up to the question by question type of test, where you can actually identify and pinpoint what they're showing some type of emotional response to. But apparently, again, according to the Plain Dealer, and that's why I wanted to quote them here, this is all they had. And so I'd be lying to you if I told you exactly what happened during this test. To me, it doesn't make a lot of sense that they wouldn't be able to identify the question, but I also don't have all the information, and I'm reporting it from this source. So if there's any polygraph experts out there, or anybody who has more information on this particular topic involving John and Shelley's case, I'm open to hearing it for sure, but this is what I have as of now. But even without knowing exactly what Stephen was being deceptive about, he did admit to a crime. So he was charged with extortion and quickly bailed out. And while he was out on bail, investigators continued to look into him, and they soon learned that he was out of town for work when the Markleys disappeared. And with that, the county sheriff told the Associated Press, quote, "There's nothing we could find that would lead us to believe he had any involvement in them being missing." When asked about theories in the case, the sheriff said, quote, "There's nothing we can grab onto solidly. We have several things going on I'd rather not talk about, but nothing concrete." And this is a little demoralizing, right? You want to find John and Shelley. You want to find those responsible. And this is a huge break in the case. You have this extortion plot that's foiled. You have this guy who has means, motive, opportunity, at least you believe he does. And then when you start digging into it, you realize that it's physically impossible that he had committed this crime. And I would also like to think, and we're going to come back to this in the perspective, but even with this alibi being in place, I would hope that a photo of Stephen Durst was taken to this teller and shown to her to confirm this wasn't the same guy that was in the truck with John and Shelley. That's cop 101. I would be mortified if that didn't occur, even with the alibi. So I'm going to assume that that is the case and that they did do that, and they were able to conclude that the person in that truck with John and Shelley was not Stephen Durst, which means at minimum, you have another guy, you have an accomplice. So that's tough because now essentially you're back to square one because it's starting to look more and more likely that maybe Steven is just an asshole, right? Just trying to capitalize on a horrific situation. And so what do you do? You got to keep your head up. You got to keep fighting. You were this close. You can get there again. And you have to hope that whoever has them makes a mistake, did something that wasn't planned, and maybe they left a piece of evidence behind, or there's someone out there like the teller who saw something that they were hoping nobody caught. And that's what you got to do. You got to go find it. It's not going to fall on your lap. You got to keep being aggressive. You don't want to give too much away. And that's kind of what he's doing here, right? This is definitely a blow. There's no other way around it. I can tell you right now, inside, investigators are demoralized, realizing that the guy that they have in custody or the guy that they're going after may not be the person they're looking for. But you got to keep going. You have to keep fighting, and you have to continue to at least display a strong show of force. At least let the person out there who sure as hell is watching not think for a second that they can put their head on a pillow and relax. You have to at least create the illusion that you're on to them, which can result in them making mistakes. Now, back to our buddy Steven real quick, because I'm sure you're wondering about him. His case did go to trial for the extortion charge, and he was found guilty, and he was sentenced to serve 4 to 10 years in prison. In my opinion, not enough, but I get the minimum sentencing standards and how that all works there. I hope he did closer to the 10 years because it would have been well deserved. So with Steven behind bars, the investigation continued, with investigators checking out every tip and lead they could think of. They conducted searches with dogs and divers whenever tips came in. They kept up on the newspapers, following up on stories involving unidentified bodies, but unfortunately, nothing was ever connected to John and Shelley. The case eventually became stagnant, and by December of 1996, a full year had passed since John and Shelley disappeared. And according to the county sheriff, the investigators had followed up on every lead that came in. 3 years later, John and Shelley were declared legally dead. And after that, there were very few public updates in the case. In December of 2015, 20 years after John and Shelley disappeared, the sheriff's office provided a brief update, but it wasn't a good one. They said the case had hit a roadblock, but beyond that, no new information was shared. And that's where things stand today. John and Shelley remain missing. No suspects have ever been named, and their families are still left searching for answers. All right, let's dive into this perspective, and I want to start with what actually happened, because I do think through critical thinking, reasonable deduction, and the evidence we do have, it does paint a picture. There was a lot of evidence at the home that suggested whatever occurred, it was unexpected. I believe that John and Shelley were probably in the kitchen drinking their coffee, talking to each other, having a conversation, and they were met by someone. Maybe they knocked on the door, maybe they just let themselves in. And if they were allowed in, well, that's a clear indication that John and Shelley knew this person, but we don't know. We don't know that at this point. But what we do know is that there were things in the home that clearly suggest they were caught off guard, and then there was something that happened inside where it was a rush. There was a panic. There was a lot going on. And they were being forced to do things relatively quickly, right? You had the coffee pot that was still on and had boiled over and was basically dry. You had Shelley's cigarettes and lighter that were still on the table, and she never left home without them. Couple that with everything else that we had. The safe being on the bathroom sink. The bed not being made with their clothes from the viewing and funeral ready to go. Just a lot of things that would indicate they were in the middle of their mourning when this all went down. You have the gun collection cabinet being open. You have the safe being open. You also have John's watch on the shelf. And to me, and this is just a shot in the dark, I think the watch was taken off by this person, or John was told to take off this watch and they forgot to take it after whatever happened. And so what did happen? It's possible that this person or people went to the Markley home with the intention on taking what they could and then getting out of there. But based on what we have, and based on the fact that John and Shelley were removed from the home, it's possible that while they were there, they didn't get what they expected. They weren't satisfied with the results of the robbery. The watch at first might have been a start to something, but when they went in the gun cabinets or when they opened the safe, maybe there wasn't much of value inside. And knowing that they couldn't leave there without anything, they decided to take John and Shelley with them. And whether there were two people or one person, someone got in the truck with John and Shelley, and that would make sense. You got to keep them in control, right? You don't want them taking off. So I would imagine that there were at least two people involved. That would be my opinion. Why? Well, they had to get to John and Shelley's house somehow. And so if you have one guy in the truck with John and Shelley, then that means someone else has to drive the car that they came in. It would also align with them dumping John and Shelley's car at a plaza and needing a second car to be there as well to pick them up and take them to wherever they went. So my belief is that there were at least two people. That would make sense when you're going into a house with at least two people inside. You want to maintain control, keep eyes on both parties. If you have to separate, you can have one person go with one victim while the other person stays with the other victim. And that's probably what happened here. Started making John take off his watch, any valuables that anybody had. They were going to rummage through the safe, take whatever they could out of the gun cabinet. And when they got done, they were like, where is everything? Where's the cash? Where's the valuables? This isn't what we came here for. And so they made the decision to leave and to go to the bank, which was close by and had money in it. And so if I had to guess, more than likely, while John and Shelley are in that car and that guy's right next to him, the teller can't see it, but he's got a gun on him. Because otherwise, I would have expected John or Shelley to give some indication to the teller that something was wrong. And they never did that. And in most cases, when you see that, it's because even though there's nothing visible, they are in a really bad spot where if they make even one slight adjustment, one small move that this guy interprets as them trying to tip off the teller, he could kill them both. And maybe at this point they're thinking, okay, he just wants the money. Once he gets it, he's going to leave us alone. And I'm sure that's what he was telling them. Unfortunately, that wasn't the actual plan. At this point, clearly things have not gone the way they were planned. This person has no mask on. John and Shelley has seen their face, and they're a liability. They can't let them go. So at that point, a decision is made to bring them to a different location. I don't know what was told to John and Shelley to get them to comply, but for whatever reason, they did. And I think that's why the car was so dirty. As I said at the top of the show, there's a lot of woods in that area. They could have went anywhere. To me, that would suggest someone with a familiarity with that area and someone who's probably from there. And so they drive the truck out there. And I do believe, unfortunately, that wherever they ended up, John and Shelley were killed. And then the truck was taken from that location back to the plaza where it was locked, left behind, and the suspect and or suspects fled the scene. Speaking of suspects, who would be on my list? Well, first off, Stephen Durst would still be on it. He may not have physically carried out this act, but as I've talked about in this episode a few different times, based on what was done here and the fact that the Markleys weren't in like this residential neighborhood with a ton of houses around, this house was specifically chosen. The Markleys were specifically chosen. And how would you know what was inside if you had never been there before? How would you know that John didn't keep a gun nearby and as soon as you walked through the door, he was going to blow your head off? There was some counterintelligence there. There was some understanding of the layout and maybe that the kids wouldn't be home at this time. There was some information that was gathered prior to this. I have to believe that someone who had a previous relationship with John and Shelley, or at least a brief interaction. And Stephen Durst would have that. He lived with them. Add on to that, he had a financial motive. He did not like John. He felt like he screwed him. He felt like he robbed him. So even though Stephen may not have carried this out, is it possible that he enlisted the help of others? Maybe he didn't even directly do that, but maybe he was just complaining about what had happened at a bar or at a restaurant around some not so nice individuals. And they either approached him or just overheard the conversation and decided to act on it based on what Stephen was saying. Either way, in my opinion, there's still a possibility that Steven is somehow tied to this. Maybe not even directly, but somehow the previous information he had about John and Shelley in their home plays into this, especially when you consider the fact that he had an axe to grind, and it just so happens to be involving money. But I just want to clarify here, after all these years, 30 plus years, he's never been charged. And that's important. I don't want anybody doing anything on their own. But my gut tells me there could be some connective tissue here. And if we had all the answers, Stephen Durst's name might be in the mix. But let's just say, for the sake of this conversation, that Stephen's not involved. He has nothing to do with it. I still think the storyline that we've just discussed with Stephen is applicable. Is there another coworker, maybe an ex-coworker, or a family member or friend who's had a negative interaction with John? Was this his MO? John, I mean, where if he had something go wrong with an employee, he was tough on him. He would withhold money. He would keep checks. And maybe there's someone else out there who was scorned and had negative feelings toward John and could have been outside at an establishment, at a get-together, talking negatively. Maybe they have friends who are not the best people, and they decided that they were going to get back at him. And they knew the layout of the home, maybe because they had been there, because they worked with John, or they had heard through Stephen, who knows? But they decided that they were going to go get what they thought they deserved. And it could have been them alone, or it could have been with the help of accomplices. Again, I believe it's more than one person. So that's really what we got to look at here. I don't think this is just some random act of violence where someone or a couple people were driving down this main road and decided to turn into the Markley household, not knowing what was inside. This was someone who knew they were doing pretty well. Their house was paid off. They had a safe in the house. He owned a business. They had some money, and they wanted it. That's my opinion. And so we got to go back, and we got to look at everybody in John's life. Did he have any financial issues with anybody? Any ex-employees? Any current employees? Any business competitors, anyone who may have had access to his household at some point, or at least knew the inner workings of his household and what he might have inside. And this isn't only just ex-coworkers or employees. This also rolls down to neighbors and friends. Anybody he might have helped out or chose not to help out in the past, could there be somebody who's pissed off at him or Shelley and decided to take matters into their own hands? And so you got to compile that list. You got to try to get names, date of births, and photos of as many people as possible, including any associates of Stephen Durst's. You put that photo array together and you go visit that teller and you show her every photo for as long as it takes. And you don't tell her anything about these individuals. In fact, you throw in random photos of people who have nothing to do with the case. And you go through them and you let her look. And you see if during that process, anyone causes a reaction and maybe causes her to sit there and point and go, that's the guy. That's who they were with. And why am I so focused on this mystery man? This is your suspect. This is either the guy or one of the guys. Why do we know that? He never came forward. They put out public information about this person. Nobody ever popped up and said, yeah, that was me. They owed me some money. They were bringing me to get the check and I went on my way. Nothing. That's because they don't want to be found. So if we find this guy, we find the person responsible for taking John and Shelley. It's that simple. And that's the main thing that I would be focusing on. But just to throw one more thing that's a little outside the box, and I don't even know if it's still possible. It's been a lot of years, but I would love to know where John and Shelley's truck is. And the reason being, I would want to know how it was preserved. Was there any of the dirt from that truck collected? Was it put into evidence? Do we still have it? Why is that important? We have advanced in a way where there are geologists out there who can take a soil sample and find certain bacteria or rock formations or soil types and analyze it and actually pinpoint it to a specific area in a geographical location. We've seen it with crime scenes where there's soil found on victims and they're able to identify a specific location where that person would have been prior to them being found. It's a long shot to think that they swabbed this truck and took soil samples, but I've seen it before. Maybe it happened here. And if they've done that, or if the car is still available, you can still do that. And yes, you would have to go around to just random locations and take soil samples and compare them to the soil sample from the car. But at this point, if you've really hit a quote-unquote roadblock, what do you have to lose? You have guys working the job. I'm sure there's someone available to go around, go to some different areas, and just collect random samples and see if anything's close. And if you get a hit, then you can explore that area further. Now, if the experts in that field tell me that the soil would all be the same, well, then you can't go there. But I wanted to mention it because you never know who's going to be listening or watching this episode. And maybe what I'm suggesting can't exactly be implemented the way I'm describing it, but it could lead a person who's close to the case, who knows the evidence they do have, to think of another idea that they hadn't thought of before. And lastly, I always like to end on you guys. I know that where the Markley home was located, it was secluded, but where their vehicle was dumped, that was pretty populated. And that road was busy. Their road was busy. And I'm hoping there's someone who may have saw something and at the time didn't think it was important, but now years later, they're realizing they may have been the witness to a crime. Or maybe there's someone who's connected to the person responsible and for many years didn't want to come forward, but now after hearing the story or seeing something about it, they want to do the right thing. And it's never too late to do that. So just to recap, 36-year-old John Markley and 32-year-old Shelley Markley were last seen on the morning of December 15, 1995 at their bank in Bloomfield, Ohio. Later that day, their five children came home to find their house unlocked and their parents gone. Days later, the couple's truck was located abandoned and covered in dirt in Warren, Ohio. More than 30 years later, John and Shelley are still missing and their disappearance remains unsolved. Anyone with information or questions regarding the case should contact the Trumbull County Sheriff's Office at 330-675-2540. As always, my final words go out to the friends and family of John and Shelley, specifically their children, Ruth, Stacy, Bonnie, Crystal, and John Jr. To think you guys left for school that morning only to come home and have your parents be gone and to never see them again. Horrific. No child should have to go through that. No child should have to go Christmas after Christmas not knowing if your parents are still out there somewhere. And 30 years later, I know it's not any easier. And you're probably still hurting. And we're here with you. And we're still thinking about your mom and dad. And we're hoping that we can help in some way, shape, or form. Not only to figure out what happened to them, where they are, but who's responsible. They need to be held accountable. And I'm hoping that covering this case may drum up some new leads or maybe elicit some investigators to get involved and maybe reach out to me. Whatever it takes, I'm here with you guys. I'm here to help any way I can. And I hope very soon we get some new updates. And one of them is, hey, listen, we have the person in custody. We know who's responsible for this. I really hope I get that opportunity. But until that day comes, everyone stay safe out there. And I'll see you soon.
It is Ryan Seacrest here, and I have discovered a fun new escape from the daily grind, Chumba Casino. Chumba Casino has hundreds of social casino-style games as all free to play anytime, anywhere with daily bonuses. So get to chumbacasino.com.
No purchase necessary. VGW Group. Void where prohibited by law. See terms and conditions. 21+.